BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Style It Radio. Well, I'm coming to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op studio in the centre of town. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to listeners in Preston, South America as per usual, and all over the world accessing the show on the internet. We have two studio guests this week. Adrian Gibbs is here to talk about the best way to optimise waste management in Bristol, an emotive topic at the moment given the bin men strikes recently, and Sarah Joy will be singing her own compositions and playing the acoustic guitar. Features by Tony Gosling and Anthony Page are dialect reporters, as usual, and Malcolm Greaves reads another excellent instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. Jeff Sparks is here to bring us the very latest in What's On in Bristol as ever, and I am John Peters Coleman. I'm in the studio here with Adrian Gibbs. A little bit about Adrian that I've been told here. Adrian comes from an engineering background and has been involved in waste and environmental management since doing a PhD on a landfill site in the Welsh Valleys. That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it's joyful, yeah. Somewhat breezy from time to time, too.
Okay, working for Eunomia Research and Consulting in Bristol, he's developed broad experience in scientific techniques for environmental assessment, such as life cycle assessment and cost-benefit analysis. Now, that sounds all very dry, but I guess that's talking about what happens to all of the stuff we put in the recycling bin once it's been sent away.
Indeed, yeah. It's provides the scientific background for making decisions upon which we recommend sensible solutions to waste management.
Okay. So what is the big deal? Why should we be concerned about the waste that we produce and where it goes afterwards once we don't see it anymore?
Every year, each household around the country will produce about 1 tonne of waste.
Right.
And in the UK, at the moment, we're achieving nationally and here in Bristol as well the recycling rate of about 35%. So that leaves a significant amount of material which is not being recycled back into new products again, and it's being disposed in some form or other.
Right.
So currently over 50% of our waste is going to landfill. There are many real problems with landfill. Not least is the sort of the seagulls and the odour and things that local residents nearby observe. But the climate change implications of landfill are really quite serious as well.
Okay, so how do we get from landfill sites to climate change? What is happening in the middle there?
The biggest problem is to do with the material that you put in your bin, which will break down in landfill.
Yeah.
So any food waste, any paper, textiles, anything that's sort of a readily degradable fraction will break down in landfill and turn into methane, which is a very, very powerful greenhouse gas. And it's this effect of landfill which is causing a huge amount of the UK's climate change gases.
Right. I have heard tell that in the future, this sort of future that we're told about, we'll be able to simply blast into space. what are we going to do in the meantime? Well, that's not really an option.
There is an optimised way of presenting waste management, and it all starts with you in your household reducing the amount of waste that you produce. So if you go to a supermarket and you can avoid taking a plastic bag, do that. If you're if you are collecting a lot of packaging in products that you buy, take it back to the supermarket and give it back to them. They shouldn't be giving it to you in the first place.
Right.
So that's a very good start. That's the very top of the waste hierarchy that we call it.
Mm-hmm.
The next step is to reuse anything that you possibly can, so find alternate uses for plastic bottles, reuse them as on a daily basis.
They can be very useful, incidentally. Plastic cola bottles can be turned into a backpack if you want to make a Ghostbusters costume for your children. This is very successful and was very entertaining. Just an idea.
So, yeah, I've seen a fair few of that on White Ladies Road on a cycle ride home in the evening. But other things you can do are to look after the waste in your own household. So try not to leave leftovers on your plate at the end of a meal. Mm. And if there are any, then put them out on the compost heap.
So, I mean, these small things do make a big difference when it comes to the bigger picture. You mentioned sort of recycling. Why, you know, this is probably quite a bugbear to residents everywhere, because we've had to now put up with a fortnightly waste collection, which people find to be a bit of a problem. Why do we have to have a fortnightly collection?
Well, I'm going to put myself out on a limb here, and I'm going to have to say that I would say fortnightly collection is a very good idea, because it is providing it, that impetus for you to do something else. It's deliberately supposed to be annoying. It's not the disposal route that we want to encourage. Mm. Recycling is the next step down in the waste hierarchy, and anything that we can do to force material into the recycling routes is taking it out of disposal, which leads to these climate change problems.
Okay, how are we doing in Bristol in terms of waste compared to other places?
Bristol's actually very average. It's 35%, which matches the national average. There's a county, a district in Lincolnshire that's recycling at the moment about 58% of its material.
Right.
And that's certainly not the highest around Europe either. Okay. We can learn a lot of lessons from European waste management.
Are we lagging a bit?
We are. We've come a long way in the past few years, but there's still a lot of ground to cover. One of the useful things that Bristol have done in recent years is to roll out food waste collections. And this is one measure by which we can really increase our recycling rate.
Right.
But the council really needs to be encouraging the use of this a lot more, because just not enough people are using the system.
Okay, what else could happen to non-recycled waste that might be an all right idea, you know, for getting rid of stuff? I mean, do you feel enough is being done to, for example, lobby government to try it, or lobby the industry, or who is really responsible for all of the packaging and wasteful stuff, really?
In the UK, the packaging producers, they're not being lobbied hard enough. In fact, the legislation isn't written in the way that they are responsible for the waste that they put onto the market.
Right.
It's up to us as residents to do our own little bit of lobbying, and where we have material which is overpackaged, phone up training standards. Mm. And say that there's too much material out there.
In terms of moolah, in terms of money, what does waste cost us as individuals? Because it might be, I guess it's hidden costs, really, because people aren't forking out their wallets. Doesn't mean there isn't a cost.
No, and this is really what sets the UK apart from most other European countries, is that there's no direct cost to any individual household for the waste that they produce. Whereas in Europe, in most of the European countries, anything you throw away, you're charged for, either by the weight or by the volume that you put out. So there's a direct incentive there for you to recycle more.
Do you think that people are going to tolerate that in this country? It's not going to be very popular, is it?
The government have been looking at it over the past couple of years, but obviously, you know, we're dealing with politics here and nothing's easy.
Yeah.
It hasn't been taken forward to the extent that we would like, because we know that if it did, it would have a very good impact, and residents would be forced to recycle a lot more. But as it is at the moment, waste is funded partly through council tax and partly through central government taxation. And here in Bristol, as you know, we're a pretty highly taxed demographic in terms of the council tax that we pay.
Mm.
But it's actually not very much of that. It goes to waste services.
Okay, yeah. I mean, if we're trying to increase the efficiency and how much we recycle, I mean, the population is going to increase. And also in the southwest quite a lot, because there's a lot of new towns being built and the population is increasing. If they try and increase sort of the efficiency of these services, is that just going to be like sort of treading water a little bit?
Well, yeah, this is another emotive topic, because the council at the moment is proposing massive housing developments. There are potentially integrated solutions, such as combined heat and power coming from, let's say, anaerobic digestion facilities, which treat food waste that's separately collected and generate energy from it and put it back into the community again.
Okay, so we could use the opportunity while we're building new towns to build new efficient ways to
indeed,
use the
indeed.
Waste at the same time.
Um, But the towns that they're proposing are over-providing housing in the local area.
Okay. What final words do you have to people on the topic, just to sort of finish us off, really?
I would encourage people to keep recycling. I would say please start using your food waste collection systems. It's clean and it doesn't smell. It's leaving your household every week. That's the idea of having the fortnightly residual waste collection. You can go onto the internet and have a look at the westofengland.org/waste website, and you can comment there a little bit more. They have a consultation that's open at the moment on how to deal with residual waste. And also, I would say if you're interested in the housing developments that are going on in the area, then go to the Friends of the Earth website and have a look at the Southwest Regional Development Plan campaign that they're running there at the moment.
Okay, particularly in the Southwest, as we're a very sort of countryside and rural area, I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in that if they have the opportunity. Adrian Gibbs, thank you very much for coming in, and well, best of luck with your future.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you to Tony Gosling for our next feature. Serious doubts remain about the killing in July 2005 of Brazilian electrician Jean-Charles de Menezes, and has gone unpunished. That crime has gone unpunished. The recent news that the police and the SAS colluded before the inquest to agree their story together is a break with the rule of law that many people cannot believe is being allowed to pass without legal redress. But this is not the only problem with the official story of what really happened in and around Stockwell Underground Station, as Dialect's Tony Gosling discovered when he spoke to retired West Country orthopaedic surgeon David Halpin.
Halpin, a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon, with a good training in pathology, I hasten to add. That is the abnormal workings of the body. I became interested in shocked with the death of Jean-Charles, the brutality of it, and the way some people were saying, well, this is just what comes of having to protect ourselves from terror. And my interest, I didn't take any close interest until I think I saw a piece in the Morning Star, which spoke of the pathologist, a man called Dr. Kenneth Shorrock, Home Office pathologist. I think actually he was privately employed, but he was on their list, that he'd carried out the post-mortem, and that he was under investigation, shall we say, by the General Medical Council on the main charge being of serious professional misconduct. I think that was the charge. And there were eight charges, particular charges, underlying that. My interest was aroused, and I later got the details from the General Medical Council, because those are meant to be open, and in fact they were cooperative about it. And the essence was, this was in 2000, he'd carried out a post-mortem on a lady who'd had a kidney cancer removed, and she'd bled to death in the first 24 hours. The surgeon was a man with an Arab name, somewhere from Dewsbury, I think, something like that. Anyway, he wrote a report on his post-mortem findings, which found no fault with the way the operation had been carried out. But 2 years later, he produced a second report on this lady, I think at the instigation of the local coroner, who was concerned about the number of post-operative deaths in this hospital, perhaps related to the surgeon, I don't know. And this second autopsy report made no reference, as far as I can remember from all the records, to the first report. And in the second report, he found reasons to criticise some aspects of the surgery.
So is that normal to make reference to other reports if you're making a second one?
Of course it is. Of course it is. If you're writing, particularly on a corpse, you know, if you might write a second report on, say, a living victim of a road accident, and write a second report, but you'd always refer to the first. I would anyway. And particularly in an autopsy report, particularly which where the findings were contradictory, in essence, to the findings of the second report. So, obviously, I think what happened, I think 2002 this second report came up. They then, in fact, went for the surgeon, and then the surgeon's lawyers looked into it, and obviously their defence was that here was pathologist who'd provided a second report, which was different from the first. The first one raising no questions, the second one distinctly raising questions. So that's when the GMC thing kicked in, I believe.
Can you just tell us who the GMC, the General Medical Council, are?
The General Medical Council, can't remember how they... It's in fact got, I think it's got statutory authority from Parliament, I think. It's composed of composed of doctors, surgeons and physicians and others, and some lay people too now. That was added, I think, with a matter some years ago when there was discontent about how it was working. A man called Cato is the president or chairman. And so he was eventually, I don't know how long the process took, but he was charged with that. He was charged with serious professional misconduct based on these two reports and one not referring to the previous one. Anyway, that's how it was. And then the next thing, this is what I found out about from the records, and this is all on the record. There were some adjournments of his hearing. They're always heard. There were some adjournments. He carries out the examination of Jean-Charles's body and makes his report. But I felt, as a doctor particularly, and as a citizen, that it was improper for Dr. Shorrock to be carrying out any autopsy for the Home Office, high profile like Jean-Charles or not, because it had not been resolved whether he had committed serious professional misconduct. And the most important thing, of course, is that someone who was under such a charge like that might be working under some duress. And here was a highly political case, you know, a young fellow shot, you know, sitting in the, you know, who did not vault over the thing. There are other things emerge as well about it. I'll just say one thing in passing is that I forget what day it happened, I think it was a Thursday it happened. The IPCC did not have...
That's the Independent Police Complaints Commission.
Yes. And they did not have possession until the Monday. That was 4 days.
How do you mean, possession?
They didn't have investigating officers on the scene of death, on the scene of the murder scene. You know, they were taped off, all bullet casings left where they were, everyone stopped, you know, they had the SO-19 squad down there.
That's the police, is it, or anti-terrorist?
Anti-terrorist squad, actually. And I think, according to the Times article, they had SAS people in them as well, which I would question the legality of that, because, you know, we're not meant to be ever policed by our forces. But they were in, it is said they were there. Let's leave that aside. We don't know the facts about that. But here is a man is killed in the most brutal circumstances. People who were sitting around him on the tube train at Stockwell, I think, were greatly disturbed what they saw, because there would have been not much left of the right side of his head, perhaps. I don't know, but it was a particularly revolting death. They had no possession. They didn't get to the scene. They were kept away, as you probably know, by Blair, the chief constable, as far as I know. I think he didn't want them involved. And anyway, not till Monday, I think this is correct. Did they take over the scene? Well, I'd want to know is, you know, was all the crime scene, was it left as it was? I don't know. But I think since 4 days had passed by and there were troop trains, did they run through the station? I don't know, but that's one question. Now, going back to the Dr. Shorrock and the fact that his qualification, I mean qualification not on basis of his pathology degrees or his experience as a pathologist, but in regard to whether this charge by the GMC limited his ability to work and speak freely, or whether he was competent to. If I'd been charged with serious professional misconduct as a surgeon, I don't think people would be too happy to be operated on by me. That's the fact of it. I wrote, put the facts, and they are all matters of record. They're not me thinking something. They're matters of the GMC or whatever. I put this in a two-page letter, a 2A4 letter, to the Attorney General. And I also communicated with people before this. It wasn't just at the time of the inquest. I also wrote to the assistant accused barrister, to Mr. Mansfield, who was representing the family. I wrote to the public solicitor. I wrote to Simon Israel, the Channel 4 legal correspondent. I wrote to Harriet Wistrecht, the incentive by recorded delivery, who was the solicitor representing the family. And later I sent it to Justice for John, a support organisation to publicise and to ask for the right to ask for the best inquiry. And I had a conversation with a woman called Estelle. She has never replied to my letter. The only people who've replied to my letter, interestingly, is the Attorney General. And I got a letter from, in fact, a minister called Coker, who told me, and this is of some interest, is that Dr. Shorrock had been looked at by the Home Office under a scientific committee or something, which examines the competence of their officers in their various functions, and that they had looked at the dual autopsy reports, and they regarded the production of the second autopsy report without reference to the first, and being different from the first, as being a procedural error. Eventually, after three adjournments, Dr. Shorrock was heard, came before the GMC, that's after Jean-Charles' death and his examination of his body and the circumstances, and he was found, I'm pretty sure of my facts, but I'd like to see them in writing because I haven't looked at it for a long time. He was found guilty on all eight charges, I think, of serious professional misconduct. And he was given a warning. So that's how it's left. But the thing which I find most disturbing, Tony, is that not one lawyer, apart actually from the Attorney General, sees fit to reply to the proper concerns of a citizen, doctor, surgeon, with a good knowledge in my training from St. Mary's of pathology. And I need to remind any people listening that after the inquiry into the mass murders caused by Shippen, that Dame is not, there are unsatisfactory aspects to this, but Dame Janet, something on Smith, I think her name was, she said that doctors, we are very important people in this, that if we have any concerns about wrongdoing, we should expose them. So I've done exactly what Dame Janet or Janice has said that I should do. The pathologists who had to remove the bullets from the corpse, some of them wouldn't have been there anyway, they'd have fallen out by the sound of it. They were Remington bullets, hollow tip bullets. The ordinary name for it is dum-dum. The lead, because there's a drilling in its nose, the lead expands like a mushroom, and it causes more severe tissue damage. So if a person has his finger, this will be the justification for it. If he has his hand on the trigger from a suicide bomb, I'm not sure, in fact, it would stop it, actually, to be frank about it, if the fellow was determined. But the idea is that by causing such damage in the brain, that the brain wouldn't work. That's the essence of it. There was a lady working for the Independent Police Complaints Commission, IPCC, Canadian lady. I just forget her name now, but it's been well recorded in the print media. I think there may be a DVD audio about as well. But she was working there, an online Jean-Charles case, I think, and she became aware that they were trying to silence it. And she blew the whistle. And she was very afraid. She says this actually for the next 24 hours. She's a lovely lady. It's interesting to remember that the people who've blown the whistle in recent years have been women. They're less clubbable than the damnable male. Think of Catherine Gunn, who blew the whistle, the Mandarin expert from GCHQ. You know, when they were trying to get GCHQ to eavesdrop on the other members of the Security Council before the Iraq War. And they wanted, I think it was explicit, the email that went around, it came over from America to GCHQ. They would be happy to have personal details as well, i.e. for blackmail. That's Catherine Gunn. This lady, I think it was named Van der Velt, or something. It was a Dutch-sounding name. She sounds a very resolute, decent woman. She blew the whistle, and that's one reason why the thing, in fact, became more open.
Thank you very much to David Halpin for agreeing to be interviewed, and to Tony Gosling for his time as well. And let's hope that we continue to hear more news about that, because it's a story that doesn't really make the papers anymore, but it is very important nevertheless. On to lighter things now. Sarah Joy is with us in the studio with your guitar. Hello.
Hello.
That's a very nice guitar.
It is. It's a bit special. It was a gift from a man I've never met.
Really?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, it's a good opportunity for a plug. I host and run an open no mic night in St. Werburgh's at the Miners Arms.
Okay.
It's been going for more than a year and a half now. And one of the people who attends very regularly is a brilliant blues performer, Norman.
Right.
Anyway, Norman turned up one day and said that he'd got a friend who'd got a guitar that needed a new home. And the person had to be a skint musician who would use said guitar to further their musical abilities, and would promise not to sell it or swap it or whatever. And I actually had to sign a contract. And I didn't see Norman before the end of the night that night. Oh. And I spent the whole week feeling terrible and thinking, oh no, I'm not going to get the guitar. Oh, I really want it. And he turned up the week after, and I saw him and said, you're going to say no, but have you still got that guitar?
Yeah.
And he said, it's here, and tapped the case.
Oh, lovely.
And he let me play it. And I'm not lying, I played it and I started to cry while I was playing. And I couldn't believe that he'd already said that he would let me have it before I'd even started playing. But I said, I want to play it, make sure it's going to the right person, because there's no point me taking a guitar that I don't physically get on with. And
yeah, because they've got their own personalities, haven't they?
Yeah, and I'm a bit of a wuss. I'm not as much of a wuss as I was before, but I need a guitar with fairly low action, which means that the strings are quite close to the frets, which you don't always get with an acoustic guitar.
No.
But yeah, the further away they are from the frets, the more you have to press down with your fingers. And so, yeah.
For the untechnically knowledgeable about guitars, does that make a lot of difference to the sound?
Well, if the strings are further away from the fret, they tend to have more resonance, which means that they ring out more because they've got more room to vibrate, basically. Right. But this one's got a really lovely resonance anyway. It's got quite a big sound for the small guitar that it is. So this is from Norman's friend Phil, but it's actually a Norman guitar. It's called Norman.
It is called Norman. I just spotted that. It's Norman written on it. That's amazing.
So I won't ever forget who gave it to me, which is really nice.
Okay, well, play us a tune on it.
I will. I'm going to play one of the first songs that I ever wrote. I wrote this song when I was about 19, I think. It's called Wax on the Windowsill.
Come over here, sit down with me. Listen to the answers, enjoy this time to be. It reminds me of a feeling I had. Do I think like I used to? The scent drifts through my head like a memory, a fleeting recollection of a feeling long forgotten. So I like to believe a stirring inside tells me otherwise. You hate me and you love to see me cry. You
kiss my frosted teardrops and you say they taste like wine. I fell so far so quickly, I didn't judge the depth, and now I think I'm sinking. And still, I sit still, scraping wax off the windowsill. Still, I sit still, have silence and stillness, emptiness and nothing. Oh, you're taking my words and you're using them wrong. That's not how I wrote it and that's not my song. You're taking my truth and you're making it lies. I showed you my picture and you closed your eyes. Kiss my frosted teardrops and you say they taste like wine. I fell so far so quickly, I didn't judge the depth, and now I think I'm sinking. And still, I sit still, scraping wax off the windowsill. Still, I sit still, have silence and stillness, emptiness and nothing. Oh, oh, oh. Oh.
First song that you ever wrote?
It's one of the first songs.
That's absolutely phenomenal. That's amazing. I can't believe that. Have you ever sort of released any sort of material, like an album or anything like that?
Well, I've got an album that I released. Oh, I can't remember. Well, I didn't release it. I just made an album from some recordings that I did with three different people in three different living rooms. Or I did one of them while I was on the New Deal for Musicians in a recording studio in a little house in Wales.
So I've
got an album from several years ago. It's a bit of a collage from...
Is it available? Can we get hold of such a...
You can contact me on my MySpace. That's www.myspace.com/thisissarahjoy.
Right.
So you can get me there and ask, and I'll send you one in the post.
Thank you very much, Sarah Joy. A reminder, that's myspace.com/thisissarahjoy. Our next feature is the courtesy of Anthea Page. It's an interview with a group of circus performers, all women, and they're called Circus to Palestine. They're talking about their recent trip, which was shown in a film last week at the Eastern Community Centre.
I'm Ruth.
I'm Ree.
And we're all part of Circus to Palestine.
Can you tell us about your group, please?
Circus to Palestine, it was originally started in 2004 by a lady called Jo Wilding, and they went to Iraq, which is another name we go under, which is Circus to Iraq. And they did the shows there in 2004. Obviously, after that, it became quite difficult to get to Iraq because of the situation there. Because there was leftover funds in the kitty, it was decided to go to Palestine, which is obviously another country that is affected by conflict. And we've been going there since 2006, and this is the fourth time that we've been. We did 43 shows altogether, and all of these...
In different towns.
In different towns, yeah. We travelled all over the West Bank.
Do you stay with families?
Palestinian people are very hospitable, so we were quite often just taken right into the bosom of the family, fed, watered, treated like one of the family. It was a really amazing experience.
Can you tell us about, well, what shocked you most? Because there was a lot, I've just seen the film that you made, and there was quite a bit about the image that's put across to the rest of the world about Palestine.
The way the media's portrayed, well, the way Palestine's portraying the media is that Palestinian people are terrorists. And I was, in myself, the first time I went, was surprised to see how gentle and how kind these people were. I never heard one Palestinian person actually saying a bad word against an Israeli. They would, you know, obviously make comments, you know, about the occupation and how it was affecting them, but I never once heard a Palestinian person saying, I hate Israelis, I hate Israel. You know, they were saying, I hate what's happening to us, but they weren't angry, you know, they weren't irrational. They were just very kind, loving, generous people.
And it's also portrayed that the conflict is really two-sided, but there is resistance from Palestinian people, but it's a very one-sided situation. Like, they're put under a lot of pressure from Israel. And so the way that it's portrayed is completely... It's not true.
Well,
It's so biased.
So collectively, what was the most shocking thing that you experienced while you were all over there?
One thing that I think personally upset me the most, and it wasn't by far the most shocking thing we saw or heard, was we were on a bus coming out of the West Bank, and it was the first time we'd left the West Bank to go into Jerusalem. An army lady from the IDF got on the bus with a gun and dropped something out of one of our passports and made a Palestinian child pick it up. And when he bent down to pick it up, he was about five or something, when he bent down to pick it up, a gun was pointed, like, directly at his head. And it's just... That was by far, like, not the most shocking thing that we heard or saw there, but it's just that...
The most visual kind of thing.
Really struck us. The children are brought up with this feeling of, like, of worthlessness, really. Like, that's what they're trying to sort of put into their minds, I think.
Ellie, you said you found something really shocking when you were there.
Yeah, where we went to an exhibition of photos of children from Gaza and children and adults of the damage that weapons and cluster bombs and stuff do to them, and sort of pictures of children with their faces blown off and bodies blown apart was really horrific. And also some film footage we saw of some people in a Palestinian ambulance, Crescent ambulance, getting bulldozed by a tank. That was pretty horrific as well.
Yeah, ones that haven't made it through the checkpoints, and the fact that they don't, the ambulances that don't make it through the checkpoint, that basically those people probably won't survive.
Also, there's quite severe malnutrition. You see very, very many children with rotting teeth, because a lot of the time, if there's been a lockdown, they can't get fresh fruit and vegetables, and people also have lots of cold sores, which is a sign of sort of malnutrition. Everyone's quite worn down by the occupation.
There was quite a shocking thing about the water.
Well, basically all over in the summer, especially, the water will get cut off, often because the Israelis want to fill their swimming pools up, and now it's very, very hot in Palestine, so they're left without water for days.
Is that drinking water?
Water, yeah. They can't flush their toilets, which then it becomes a health hazard. They can't cook food, people can't wash. These people are Muslim, which means they pray five times a day, and they have to wash while praying every time. This isn't unachievable. Many people would like to build their own wells, but the trouble with that is the Israelis won't give them permission. If people build them without permission, they'll be put in prison and the wells bulldozed and filled in.
So the purpose of your visit, really, is to bring a bit of happiness, is it, to people who live in very bad situations?
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, a lot of in Palestine is that children basically don't get much opportunity to play. There's not a lot of, especially in the refugee camps, I mean, there's no space, there's no green areas. I mean, the houses are very tightly packed together. You know, they might be able to play on the street, but even the streets are very small. It's a very poor country. Obviously, they don't get the opportunity. I mean, a lot of the time, this is the first show that they've ever seen. They've never seen a show. They've never seen a clown. They've never seen anything like it. They don't get to experience things that normal children, which, you know, take for totally for granted in this country. They don't get the chance to be children in Palestine because of what's happening there. So we try to go and just, you know, it's a really simple thing, but we are literally just trying there to give them a bit of
a normal childhood.
Yeah, it's like part of the Human Rights Convention. Every child has a right to play. It's just what we try to facilitate.
When you came back, did you think that there was anything that you could do?
Yes.
To help the situation.
Definitely. We asked everyone when we were there, like, what we could do and what they wanted us to do in England, and they just said to let people know that they were there and what was happening to them. And I think that just as much work can be done here. Palestine's not even on a map here. Not everyone's even aware of where it is, what's happening.
So in the film, we saw this wall. Can you explain about the wall?
It's huge.
You saw it being built, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
It was decided that this country was Israel and this country was Palestine. And what it was basically a line was drawn on a map. What Israel is saying, because they've had some sort of obviously some suicide bombings, is that they've built this. They're building the wall so for security, so that people can't enter, you know, enter Israel. Palestinians can't come into Israel. So what's happened is it started off being like a fence, like sort of a wire electric fence, and more sections that are being built. So it's quite big. I mean, it goes from
what's it built of now? Concrete.
Concrete.
It's massive concrete.
How tall is it?
4 or 5 meters tall.
It's big.
It's really huge. Big. It's absolutely huge.
And this will run along through people's backyards and through nursery schools and stuff like that.
It's just literally went through villages because it was just drawn on a map.
As well, part of it is actually also a land grab, because where they are building the wall, in theory, I mean, they should be building along the line that was drawn up to say, well, this is Palestine, this is Israel, but they're not. They're actually building sort of further and further into Palestine, so they're basically it's also a land grab basically, so they're getting more land from Palestine.
It's not in a straight line either, it's like a snake and it'll snake around.
Where's it go from and to?
It goes from the north to the south of the West Bank. It will, because on one side you have Israel and then the other side you have the Jordan River Valley, so it goes up a couple of miles above Jenin, up round and then down sort of below Hebron.
So it'd be like a prison camp.
It is a prison like that already.
It's what we call an open air prison, basically.
And they've started building walls around towns as well, like really small towns. And so, there's one Qalqilia, one town called Qalqilia, where there's one checkpoint in and the same checkpoint out, and that's it. They're just living in a prison.
And you were talking about checkpoints.
I think it's 62 checkpoints.
Yeah. About the country.
But they have
emergency checkpoints that they just decide to put up.
And there's like big ones basically around all the big towns. There's big checkpoints, and then there's just loads of other ones set up. They're like temporary checkpoints. Depending on what's happening, if there's a lot of unrest, then more checkpoints will go up.
Why do you think that they've been allowed to treat the Palestinians like this?
There's various reasons why. A lot of Palestinians think it's because of the guilt of the Holocaust that is felt collectively around the world, that nothing's been done about it. Personally, and I think this is the opinion of a lot of people, Israel's quite a strategic place in the Middle East. That is the only country that's sympathetic to the West. So for the West, you know, they don't basically want to upset Israel. I can't see any other reason why that would be allowed to continue, because it breaks every convention, a human rights convention that I think has ever been made virtually on a daily basis.
Palestine's quite topical at the moment because of obviously everything that happened in Gaza. But while Gaza was actually being covered in the news, lots of stuff was happening in West Bank that just didn't get covered. Like a lot more settlements got built in West Bank.
Can you explain to people what you mean by West Bank, Palestine and Gaza?
Palestine was all one country and then it got divided. So Israel's in the middle and Gaza's on the west side.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Gaza's
on the west side.
It's like 25 kilometres in length and 7 kilometres wide. So it's a tiny, tiny, tiny place.
And then the West Bank's on the opposite side. So they're both Palestinian, but they're just completely separate from each other.
The Palestinians fled because they got told there was going to be a war, and then it made two camps, and that's what Gaza is and that's what West Bank is, but they weren't able to return home.
It all sounds really negative, and there's a lot of negative things happening there, but one really positive place, I think it's near Jaffa, but it's a small town, basically, and it's 50% Israeli, 50% Palestinian, and they're living together, and it was set up for that purpose, where people could live together and the kids go to school together, they learn about each other's religions, I don't think that they've got like a synagogue or a mosque there. I think they have like a praying place. People are living together, and that's proof that it can work and that people can bring their kids up in that environment, and people can understand each other's cultures and respect each other's cultures.
And the one thing that all the Palestinians you met were like, well, what do you want us to do? And they're like, we just go back and tell people what's happening here.
It sounds so awful when you talk about it, but it was just the most amazing experience. We all had such a good time, and the one thing that stays with you more than anything, more than all the things that you see there, is just how amazing the people are there, how warm and kind they are there, and I would go back in a flash if I could.
Are you on Facebook or...
We're on Facebook. It's called the group is called Circus to Iraq, which is obviously the name of originally, and there's all the information in there and photos from our last tour if you want to.
Thank you very much to Circus to Palestine. It's time now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. And the people and the customers he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. And the intro music, for the curious, is a tune called Old Molly Oxford and was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub, which is in King Street. Very nice pub. If you'd like to play with them, they meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session. And you can just turn up and join in.
Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Guy and Storm Chapman. For the whole winter, a very hard one, Guy Chapman and Storm Jameson have been with us swallowing their breakfast every morning in 5 minutes and smashing their horrid little car at 50 miles an hour to Prince's Risborough for the London train. A lovable couple and a good blend, where she is masculine, he is feminine, and vice versa. Kate loved her from the start. I didn't. Bless her untidy head, which in these 6 months has made a dear grease mark on the wall by Chapman's table. Guy gave me his pretty little cookery book, Anne Blencow, 1694, which he published himself, and I managed to get out of it the following dinner for them. Peas soup. But done in the superfluously elaborate way of all old recipes. Fried oysters. Drobed beef. Almond flummery. Biscuit, Mrs. B's way. Lady Gage's surfeit water, so strong as to fill a common chamber pot in 12 hours. They pronounced it excellent and used it in their Times advertisement for the book. Later, poor Guy and Storm have to live at Tunbridge for their boy Bill. We got a letter from a landlady in Kent, they having given us as references. We thought it was generally rather an insolent one. Anyhow, his wife, instead of Mrs. Chapman, wasn't proper. So Kate wrote what was also a fitting epitaph to their many months of sojourn here. Mr. and Mrs. Chapman are charming and honourable people, and you are fortunate to be in a position to do them service. Which is characteristic of Kate's directness when she has a conviction. Some Scotsmen. Financier, complete with wife, said Charles Nielsen, as an immense Scotsman, holding her violet pressed leather jewel case, helped out of the car his tiny little wife, draped tight in black satin, and then dined. He told me his family had been on their estate since the 11th century. After dinner he stood up and said, I'd like to reward the waitress, who was not forthcoming, so he put down on the table a pile of 3 or 4 coppers. Blast his Scotch carefulness, I thought. But somehow I couldn't dislike their great kindness in other ways, so I took them out, and having shown them how to get to the garden, I ran back, and being ashamed before Phyllis, took 1/2 crown out of my pocket to exchange with the pile of coppers. But when lifting them up, I found 2 half-crowns below. 11th-century unostentation, I thought. But afterwards I wondered why he'd done it so. Was he afraid of the little wife seeing his generosity to the girl? Or did he think I'd snap it up myself if it looked worthwhile? But I decided in terms of the 11th century. 3 polite actions, all Scotch. 1. Father Trail, sitting talking with me in the office, had put his burnt-out match and all his cigarette ashes on his hat before I noticed his difficulty. 2. E. M. Wrong of Magdalen started putting his ashes into the turn-up of his trousers. 3. Lord Scarrington, who, before going away, said, Master Fothergill, could you spare me 2 dozen of your excellent East India sherry? Yes, of course. But, he said, at a reasonable price. I do not consider 105 shillings reasonable. Will you allow me to give you 125 shillings? And many another lovely courtesy. Unhappily, the last two are dead now. Lord Skerrington, after 3 weeks here, told me how much they liked it, and how they would never stay here again. His only passion was to be on Roman roads, and a new bit every year. But Lady Skerrington, who used to arrange their annual trips with devastating circumstance and detail, wrote to me 2 months later that they would look in on us on August the 6th, 10 months hence, at 4:30. And they did. The rats. Rats overrun the house. Having consulted the relevant department of the Ministry of Agriculture, and spent £14 on its recommendations, I fell back on our local surveyor, who kindly promised to send a man to catch them, and a few days afterwards there came to the kitchen door a ragged bundle of a man, looking himself more like a fat and dusty rat, with bright little eyes, a pointed nose, and a crafty smile. They told me in the kitchen who this specimen was, generally in trouble, and from whom the children always ran screaming. They said that he catches rats in his mouth and throws them dead over his shoulder. I took him down to the cellar and watched him anxiously for an hour or more. Once he got a rat into his pocket somehow, but it got away, and I was glad to get this odious character away also. Yesterday, a girl came screaming down the stairs from the lavatory, calling out, "There's a rat! There's a rat!" and fell into the arms of her young man waiting below in the hall, who tenderly folded her to himself. For the first time, as it seemed to me. She had indeed done well to sustain the rat emotion so long, and use it so opportunely. This morning I told H.D. Wells that I'd been trying to stop rat holes for 2 hours before breakfast. "Oh, you should get that stuff that makes them so voracious that they eat one another up, till the last surviving rat goes conscientiously into every hole and corner, and finding none to eat, goes out into the yard and dies. Conscientious." Wells can turn everything to fun. When he'd been here 3 days, I told him that up until now I used to say, "All's well that ends well's." But the now, I recanted wholesale.
Thank you very much to Malcolm, and you can hear another instalment next week. Well, the big friendly Jeff is here, all dressed in black with a Wild Hearts t-shirt, so what's going on around Bristol?
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 18th of June, Beth Rowley will be performing with support from Phil King at Comedia in Bath. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Also on 18th of June, Dr. Feelgood will be performing with support from Groove Grinder at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On Friday, 19th of June, the Mangold Wurzels will be performing at the Cat and Wheel in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I dedicate this track to Ian Hardwick of the rock band Idiot 3. This is Iron Maiden, and the song is Run to the Hills.
Rain.
That was Iron Maiden with Run to the Hills. For more information on Iron Maiden, you can check out www.ironmaiden.com. And for more info on Idiot 3, you can check out www.idiot3.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday 20th of June, and Misled Youth, High Fiction Science, Smokestack Shakers, Cthulhu, Chris Scott's Blues Devil, The Exhibition and The Reach Arounds will all be performing at the Totterdown Music Festival, which is at the Shakespeare in Henry Street, Bristol. It all starts at 1 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 20th of June, the She Creatures will be performing with support from the Ouija Birds at the Croft in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 21st of June, it's day 2 of the Totterdown Music Festival. On this day, expect performances from Pete Hearn and Friends, the Shaky House Band, the Shrinks, Vanos Band, Sanja, and the Jim Tigwell Band. Again, the venue is the Shakespeare in Henry Street, Bristol, and the event starts at 12 noon, and entry is free. Also on 21st of June, UFO will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m, and tickets are £18 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Before we go, because that's all from Dialect Radio this week, I'd like to give a little shout-out to the Avon and Somerset Constabulary. Splendid people. They were very nice to me last night when I got done over and mugged in Queen Square. I don't know if they'll ever catch them, but they do a tough job, and somebody's got to do it. So if you're out there, you've got an official shout-out from the JPC. In the studio were Adrian Gibbs and Sarah Joy. Thank you very much for them both. Malcolm Creeve read another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, and the features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Jess Parks brought us What's On in Bristol, and the studio engineer was Phyllis Chipchikurin. The producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from all of us, and I'm John Peters Coleman. Take care of yourselves, and goodbye until next week.